Hello and welcome to the best of News Talk Daily. Over the next few days, we'll be bringing you some highlights from the first 6 months of the podcast. And today, we are revisiting the political scandal that became known as Golfgate.
We lost our dad in April. My husband couldn't be in
my brother
with
died
him.
A month ago. We couldn't see him for four
Business
months.
Business have been decimated. Jobs lost. Trust has been shattered.
On the 19th of August 2020, Ireland was a country on the edge.
The number of cases that we now have in Ireland is very substantially more than we were seeing even just a few weeks ago.
There is growing public concern because we have a government that has descended to new levels of chaos. In this week alone, we've had confused and contradictory guidance from the government. We have had really alarming commentary from senior ministers, including the Minister for Health.
Our children being on trampolines is an inherently risky thing for them to be.
But are we comparing that, doing? Minister, to a global pandemic?
On the night of the 19th, in a hotel in Clifton, County Galway, 81 people gathered for a dinner to celebrate the Oireachtas Golf Society.
Cabinet ministers, members of the judiciary, former politicians, former journalists, we're immune. It is insulting to people out there.
That event and the fallout that followed became known as Golfgate, one of the most politically explosive stories of the pandemic.
They all have to go. There are no exceptions. I'm horrified, really, as everyone else you will speak to will be. There has to be a recall of the Dáil in the love and honour of Christ in the middle of a pandemic. Why in the name of God is the Dáil not fitting? I'm terrorised at the idea of children going back to school.
And indeed, as we're all aware, an event in Clifton gave rise to the Taoiseach's decision to recall this Dáil early. The dinner, hosted by the self-styled Oireachtas Golf Society, should never have happened. Serious and indefensible breaches of public health regulations occurred on the 19th of August in Clifton. These breaches were either the result of collective crass stupidity or arrogant delusion, or both.
And 5 years on, we're looking back at what happened, how it played out, and whether or not it left a lasting mark on Irish politics.
I just want to apologise to all those I've let down. You know, I'm going to work incredibly hard to try and regain people's trust.
The Irish government says it's lost confidence in EU Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan over his breach of COVID-19 lockdown rules.
They started out saying I broke rules and broke laws. I was a bit sloppy on guidelines, but I didn't break any rule or any law. And I took a court case in Galway in February 2022 to actually show everybody what actually had happened and how wrong the government and the media were.
It's News Talk Daily. I'm Sean Defoe. And I'm joined by the two people reunited who first broke the story for the Irish Examiner, Aoife Moore and Paul Hosford. Good to have you both in to News Talk Daily and the dream team, like Avengers reassembled here. Paul, we might just start to bring us back, because we look back on COVID now through the lens of a lot of time having passed and things returned to normal. Like, bring us back to mid-August 2020. What was daily life like, the restrictions we were living under?
It was one of those times where cases had started to creep up. There was more restrictions. There were localised restrictions in Kildare, Offaly and Laois. So it was a very odd time, because the weather was really nice. It was actually a really nice summer. It was glorious. But we were all living under this cloud of restrictions. And we'd had a little bit of a taste of freedom almost in the June and July. Things had kind of started to ease up. And then as the cases started to creep up mid-August, I think everyone started to realise that by the time school, typical school return rolled around, we were going to be in some serious bother, and we probably weren't going to see a winter free of restrictions. So there was that cloud. So in the news media, it was constant with COVID. COVID was everything from March until probably the following year, June or July of the following year. Every day you were waking up and the first thing on your list was, what's the latest? What are we talking in terms of restrictions? What are we talking in terms of case numbers? There's the daily NPHET briefing. We all remember those in that room in the bottom floor of the Department of Health over in Mesian Plaza. So It was a very strange time, and it was one of those. It was at that point where you could start to feel public buy-in waning, because they'd given so much in March, April, May, got a bit of a glimpse of what freedom could look like in June and July, and once things started to kind of ramp up again, and once restrictions started to kind of become the norm again. It was a country that was very much teetering on the edge.
Yeah. If what do you remember that summer? Because we were all covering it. We were all political correspondents at the time. And I just remember being repeatedly in that dungeon in the bottom of the government buildings where the leaders would do their speeches. And everyone remembers the speeches on the steps. Then there was the press conference afterwards. And we all, looking back at it weirdly, we all almost self-selected our own seating. Like you became used to the same seat every week.
Because it was before masks. I don't even think we were wearing masks at that stage. And my big thing I remember is I was living in a ground floor flat, a two-bedroom flat with four adults. So it was very cramped, and everyone else that I lived with was working from home. And I was, myself and Paul and Danny, we would all choose, you know, one night after another, we would go to the NPHET briefing with Tony Houlihan, and he would tell us how many people had died that day. And when you think about it, it was like an incredibly grim, kind of like real last days on earth type experience.
So, evening all, thank you again for being with us this evening. We're reporting to you that we've been notified of an additional four deaths in the last 24 hours, bringing the total now to 1,714, 713 of which occurred in an acute hospital environment. That's 42%, 86 in an intensive care. That's 5%. And we have reports of underlying conditions in 1,579, that's 92%. The male-female breakdown is 848 males, 866 females, and the median age is 84.
And I would come home to my flat, and the people I lived with were so excited that someone had been further than like 2 kilometres. They'd be like, where did you go? What shop did you go to? What did you have for your lunch? Who did you see? Because they were stuck in the house all the time. You know, you're going to the same supermarket and coming home again. That was basically all anyone did. Apart from the fact that we all got really into, running. We all just started jogging around the estate because we had nothing to do. But I remember being in those NPHET briefings with Tony Houlihan and thinking about, because you can't help, but as a journalist, you also think about yourself and your own personal family circumstance. So my granddad was in his 80s, still is in his 80s, he's still with us. And how is this going to affect my granddad? My dad's a barman. When's the pub going to open? When's my dad going to be able to back to work? My mom works in a supermarket. She was an essential worker, God save us. So I was thinking about, you know, your own personal circumstance as well as thinking about people in nursing homes. And we were starting to hear those horror stories about nursing homes and funerals. And you're thinking about your own circumstances. Obviously, people get married, weddings being cancelled all around you, friends, christenings for their children being cancelled. We were, journalists were lucky in a way because we were distracted from it. But for the greater public, it was a horrendous time. We were just talking to your producer about this. It was definitely a trauma that we all lived through.
Yeah, and we were definitely lucky to have that pass that got you past the Garda checkpoints that you met twice on every drive on the way into town.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you felt very, very lucky that you could just go to a different supermarket. As Paul said, there was this feeling at the end of that summer that people were starting to lose their rag a wee bit. We would just come out of the election and it was a very new government. There was this feeling that the government didn't really understand the toll that lockdowns were having on people and businesses and children especially. And we were just teetering, as Paul said, teetering on that edge where patience was just starting to wear. And if one anything could have happened to push them over the edge, but it just so happened that the one thing couldn't have been worse.
Yeah. So, Paul, with that in mind, so people are kind of teetering. Like you said, there was a little bit of freedom through the summer and now we were realising, uh-oh, something's going on here case-wise. Remind us of those restrictions that were announced in the days before Golfgate.
Yeah, so what you had seen was that things like weddings, family gatherings have been cut from 25 down to 6 in some cases.
Now, I know that there has been a lot of talk and commentary about the measures that were recommended and many people are confused about what they should be doing. But at the heart of what we want to do is a very simple message. Please limit the number of people that you're meeting up with over the next 3 weeks. Specifically, please focus on two key numbers, 6 and 15. Please do not have more than 6 people over to your house or garden. And outside, no more than 15 people should meet up, and even then, people need to physically distance from one another. Please work from home if at all possible. You can still play sport, you can still go to a restaurant and meet your friends and family, but we are asking that you do this in as safe a way as possible.
And all we were getting, like Aoife says, like all you were getting when you were at the NEFA briefings was like Twitter DMs or Twitter messages. Can you ask about weddings? My wedding's booked next week. And you had to go back to these people and say, look, Tony Holohan says your 25 person wedding now has to be 6. You know, I know people who got married and had the 6. I know people who got married and had 25 or had 50. I don't think they'd have changed their days when they look back on them, but like having to make that decision in real time. And people always said that, you know, 6 is easy because you can kind of just pick your parents and one or two others, and then 25 gets more difficult. So people are having to make those calls in real time.
Yeah, I'm sure relationships never recovered in some cases.
I remember poor Paul Quinn from Virgin Media.
That's right.
Who had his wedding planned, and I think initially was meant to have 200 people there. And in the lead up, had the restrictions changed 5 or 6 times in terms of who many he could have. Like it was, but I had actually forgotten about the DMs and the amount of people who messaged every, like you couldn't ever possibly ask the amount of questions you were being given.
Yeah, every day you opened your DMs and it was like, just sometimes it was the most obscure sort of like, I have a tattoo booked and I want to get a full sleeve. I'd be like, maybe just sit for an hour and come back the next day. I like, you're giving out medical advice. I remember this so clearly. I'm not going to name and shame, but there was a very prominent politician who phoned me one day to say that he had COVID and he wanted to go out to his front garden and cut the grass. And he phoned me to ask if he was allowed. And I was like, surely there's some better place that you could phone.
This was Aoife's brief stint on NEFIT.
Yeah. Well, it felt like we were all members of NEFIT for a brief time. Yeah, we were certainly answering more questions than NEFIT were.
Yeah, and it was a good reminder of the public-facing part of this job, that you do work in service of the reader and of the audience, that, you know, you were in a press conference and you were being given questions. And some of them, like you said, were remarkably specific. Like, you know, I want to go and adopt 6 dogs on a Saturday in Laois. Can I do that? Like, how does this affect me? I'm a, you know, an artisanal beekeeper. You know, really, really full on.
Do bees carry COVID?
Yeah, there was that whole thing. And we can laugh about it now and it's good, but it was so all consuming.
Yeah.
Like my eldest child was, 5 months at the time. I was really lucky because I could go and see people. My wife was, you know, she was postpartum at home with a baby, couldn't go any further than 2 kilometres. And at the time, nothing was really built around our estate. We were only in the house a couple of years, new build. And the 2 kilometres was pretty depressing. You could you could walk to the ring road and back. Once you hit a certain traffic light, you had to come back. There was no like parks or anything. So it was, and those things, those restrictions really highlighted the fault lines of like people close to, say, the 40 foot or like Sandy Cove.
Yeah.
Their 2 kilometres was great because they could just go for a swim and there was nobody else around them. If you were close to the Phoenix Park, you could just nip into the park if you had a park on your doorstep. But as that kind of opened up and then contracted again, people were starting to get very, very, very ratty.
A very good friend of ours, he was our next door neighbour, who we loved. We couldn't visit him in his finer days. We couldn't hold his hand. He died of cancer, not COVID. We couldn't be there with him. We would have been there with him. We've had all of that. My daughter-in-law watched her granddad that she loved from a chair in her sitting room as he was cremated on a monitor on a television screen. My son said, Mom, if he just saw their faces. Do you know, we've all had that horrible, horrible heartache and pain.
Yeah. Mm. So Aoife, bring us then to the anatomy of the scoop, I suppose. When did you first get wind that something had happened in Clifton?
This is the thing I remember so clearly. So I was at a very small press conference with Josepha Madigan, who was the Minister for Disabilities at the time. One of those real COVID-specific pressers, but it was about getting air filters into special schools or something like that. So I went to this market, obviously, just to get out of the house, I think. I was like, I will go over to this. And it was in Dundrum. But anyway, I went to the press conference. Nothing exciting happened. And then I went in to a Starbucks in Dundrum. And I had finished writing up the Josepha copy, and then the email came into me and Paul. And this email was from this person who said, "This is not my video." He said, "I was sent this by a friend of mine. You should check this out." It was in the Station House Hotel in Clifton. And what the video was a very blurry, badly taken video of the seating plan for the Oireachtas Golf Society. So like when you go to a wedding,
yeah,
you know, that type of thing. And the first table I remember so clearly had Dara Cleary, who was the very new Minister for Agriculture. He was at the table, I think, with Phil, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And a number of other names that I recognised. I think me and Paul rang each other and we were like, "This is mad." So the first thing, I was like, "Let me just phone the hotel.
Mm. So, and when was, just to put it in the, because the story broke on a Friday morning, wasn't it?
No, so
when
was it was a Thursday night.
It was Thursday night.
So okay. This was at about 11 o'clock in the morning on the Thursday.
Yeah, because we, so something we jumped on at about kind of 12.
So I phoned the hotel, real breezy, real casual. I was like, "Hiya, how's it going? Just checking. Did the Oireachtas Golf Society event go ahead last night?" And this poor girl, who was probably only about, she only sounded about 20 or 21. And she was like, "Yeah, I wasn't working, but there was about 81 people there, but it went ahead, no issue." And I went, "That's great. Thank you very much." Hung up the phone, phoned Paul back and was like, "We're on." And we basically took it by table. I always remember we didn't have a lot of the phone numbers because some of them were very obscure, former politicians, whatever. Mm. We also had to agree not, because to text into the political journalist group chat to tip you guys off.
Yes.
Because if we were like, "Can we have X person's number?" they'd be like, "Why are they looking for that number?" So we were going around the houses looking for phone numbers, and we started basically going through the table plan and phoning each person. The reason I remember the cafe so clearly is because of the COVID restrictions, I was only allowed to be in the cafe for an hour. And the staff kept being like, "You have to go, you have to go." But I was living in Coolock and I was in Dundrum. And I was like, "I can't sit in this car for 45 minutes and not be working on this story." So I broke probably COVID regulations myself, trying to stay in the Starbucks, and eventually got chucked out. And then I sat in the car for a while. But we just went through every number,
yeah.
And phoned every person.
Yeah, and Sean, you know yourself when you're working on a story, like there's so many stories where you work so hard for days and days and days. And then something like this, it comes from like a tip off. And we did really good work. Like we worked hard. We got every number that we could. And Danny McConnell, who was our our political editor at the time, he was off. He was on a beach in Sligo. So we never really flagged to him that it was that it was coming. Like, till we'd sent the copy over, we were just hammering people. And, you know, it was a case of like every time we got somebody to speak, we'd ring the other back and be like, "Okay, does that tally with what you said?" And I remember somebody who was at the event said to me, "No, it was partitioned off. The argument was whether you could have 50 or whether you could have
Was the idea of there was a big massive room, but because it was in two, it was technically two separate events.
And oh, who would have thought partition would cause so much trouble?
There you go.
But when he was from the north.
You may have guessed that, who have followed her career. When you were ringing these people, I mean, did they immediately know they had done something wrong? Were there people who were like, "Oh yeah," like the receptionist that you rang?
So I phoned Dara Cleary, and he was the first person I phoned. I phoned him and said, "Dara, did you go to the Oireachtas Golf Society event in Clifton last night?" And he immediately said, "Yeah." And he said, "Do you know, when I was sitting there, I thought to myself, this isn't right. You know, I didn't investigate it enough." And he was like, "Will you give me an hour to get a statement together?" And I said, "Yeah." I says, "But I'm just letting you know, myself and Paul are running the story, whether you put the statement out or not, you've confirmed you were there. I'll give you an hour because we've got other people to phone." He wouldn't give me any more information about the event. He didn't want to talk about the rooms or the partition or anything like that. He just wanted an hour to get a statement together. So that was the first person I think we phoned.
I rang Aoife and I said, "Look, there's an argument here that they could have had 50. Is their argument. They could have had 50. And if it was split down the middle, was it 240s? Are they under the 50? And Aoife said, somebody said to me that there was a partition, but there was a hole in the partition.
The partition was open.
And I think word had kind of started to filter around at kind of 3 or 4 o'clock was when you kind of stopped getting answers to your phone calls.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I remember there was a lot of, it was mostly men saying, no, this is fine, this is in the rules, this is fine. And because we were hearing it so often, me and Paul were ringing each other going, is this fine? Mm. Were they allowed to do this?
So at what point did you, like, where did you go to get the medical advice? Because there was there are other journalists who claim they were on the verge of breaking this story. And there was a question, I think, asked at the NPHET briefing that evening by another outlet who was also following this on.
It was the ever-present Gav Riley. It had also been announced on Radio Na Gaeltachta as well, and nobody picked it up.
The previous morning, there was this piece on Radio Na Gaeltachta that was like, the Oireachtas Golf Society's in town, they're playing golf and they're going for a meal.
Going for their dinner, and no one picked up on it. But yeah, so Gav had asked the question at NPHET, but the question was so...
Gav had got Zara King.
He got Zara to ask it.
And that's what tipped me off, because Zara asked it in a very... guarded way. You know, when your listeners might not be familiar with this, but sometimes you're onto something and you have to ask it in a public way, but you have to not tip the people in the room off that you're asking the question because you're onto something. So you ask it in this really circuitous way where I think Sarah's kind of thing is like, what would your advice be for people who wanted to hold a gathering of 81 people who happened to be golf buddies?
Well, it was a bit like not messaging the WhatsApp group that exists at the political correspondence, because I think that was the moment a lot of other outlets who hadn't heard were like, something is out there. Yeah. Something is about to happen.
Yeah, and I would say I didn't see the NPHET briefing because we were still working on the story at that point. But I got a phone call from someone's advisor. Very, very nice person said, I am just letting you know that another journalist has now phoned me about this. So if you are going to publish it, you need to publish it now. We were trying to hold it for the front page of the paper the next day. Mm. We were, as you said, back to your question there about the guidance, we were going between NPHET, Fáilte Ireland was a big one as well, the Fáilte Ireland advice.
Was it the Hotels Federation had their own
Hotels
advice
Federation.
As well?
But we have a statement from the Irish Hotels Federation, and they said that they permit a maximum of 50 people at one time, including hotel staff. Multiple gatherings are allowed in a venue, provided that they are in separate defined spaces.
I was on the phone to the manager of the hotel, and me and him went back and forth for, I think the longest phone call I had that day was the manager of the Station House Hotel. And we both thought we were right, but we both had completely different views of what the rules were.
So they thought, we've done nothing wrong here, we were perfectly within the guidance, we separated the rooms, it was fine.
Yeah, basically they were very keen that they had followed all the advice to the letter, and then sure, wasn't the minister there and the AG was the Attorney General's there, so it must be right. And I was trying to say to them, I don't care who was there, mucker, this is wrong. Because then we got the tip off that Gav and Zara were on it. The story went out at 7 o'clock.
Well, I think you sent me copy and I wrapped it together and I sent it to John O'Mahony, who's now the group editor in The Examiner, and I sent it to him at 5:37 with the subject line, golf yarn. And then me and you sat for like an hour and a half.
It's right.
We were texting each other back and forth. We were like, please.
Where is it? Where is it?
It has to go up. And then we were kind of letting the desk know, like, somebody else is chasing this. And then we knew that Virgin had a bulletin at 7.
Yeah, that's right.
So we were like, it has to be gone by 7, because if not, Gav might have firmed it up. And at 7:01, it was...
Because I remember we were waiting so long, I decided to go to the gym. I was like, because gyms were open. So I decided to go to the gym and I was like, I just need to clear my head. And I remember walking into the gym and my ma phoned me. My mommy's not mad into politics or news or whatever, but she's a great gauge of like if a story is relevant or not, because she's not into it. And I said to her, mommy, I think I did something. I was like, me and Paul, I've got a really big story. She was like, what is it? And I said, told her, I was like, 81 of them had a hoolie last night. And she was like, oh, Jesus. My ma was really shocked. And then by my ma's reaction, I knew we had done something big. I went down to the gym. I stood on the treadmill and turned the treadmill on. You sent me the story and I tweeted it because at the time I had more followers. You tweeted it because you have more followers. I went out at 7:01 on Twitter. And by 7:15, I had to leave the gym because my phone was just hopping. Mm. And I was like, I'm not getting anything done. I'm just going home.
Yeah, I was lying on the bed with my wife and our son. We were trying to settle him before bed. When Aoife tweeted and we tweeted, I was like watching the retweets and watching the responses. And I was like, oh no, I think like, because you don't know. Like, you think this is a big thing, but you don't know it's going to land. And you've probably had stories where you're like, this is going to do numbers. Yeah. People are going to really care. This is going to set the agenda.
Crickets.
And it's just and we've all done it. You're like, this is so important, and it just doesn't happen. In those days, it could have been overtaken by anything. And once I saw that started to rack up, I was like, oh.
The Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Dara Kaleri, has apologised for attending an event with around 80 other guests in a hotel in County Galway which may have breached public health guidelines. The event, an Oireachtas Gulf Society dinner, took place in Clifton on Wednesday night. It's understood 45 people were seated in one room, separated by a partition from 36 people in another room. In a statement, the minister said that he should not have attended the event in light of the updated public health guidance this week.
It just exploded everywhere. The first person actually who phoned me to say well done, I don't actually like me saying this, was Catherine Murphy from the Social Democrats. But I didn't sleep at all that night. Like, my phone just didn't stop.
Aoife, your story landed 7 o'clock on the night of the 20th of August. There was a wave of reaction across social media that night. But what happened the next morning?
We were both doing so many radio shows that I would hang up the phone and then the phone would ring and I'd pick it up again and I would be on the radio and I didn't know what station I was on. I didn't know who I was talking to. It just kept going. It was just
like, you know,
a runaway train.
When like actors are doing those like satellite things for American TV and they're like, oh, it's great to talk to the people of like Phoenix or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, it was like that. Yeah. But I remember, sorry, just to come back to that night. That night, me and you phoned each other about 8 after everything was kicking off. And you said to me, I think Dara Kaleri is going to have to resign.
But it was the reaction on Twitter and I was like, oh, like this could be a problem.
So he obviously hadn't announced any intention to resign in that statement that he eventually put forward.
He apologised
to it. And you got that first whiff of it. He was obviously the first to go. So it brings the timeline of that.
It was covered on prime time that night.
Neither of us were on.
Miriam O'Callaghan did give us a shout out. So like my man was very, very impressed with that. So we got word that Dara Kaleri is going to be doing more in Ireland tomorrow. So obviously I was up anyway. I have a 5-month-old child. So we're
now into the Friday morning. It's been out for 12 hours odd. It's the front page of the Examiner. Everyone's talking about it.
Yeah. Dara Kaleri's coming up on Morning Ireland. So I turn on the computer. I'm sitting at the computer and next thing, Dara Kaleri's resigned. Statement drops in. 7 o'clock in the morning, gone. Not doing Morning Ireland. Fallen on his sword, has spoken to the Taoiseach. He's gone. Which I think he deserves an awful lot of credit for. I think he could have dragged it out and kind of tried to cling on, made the technical argument. I think in the long term, it's been of benefit to his career that he didn't. He'd just become agriculture minister after the Barry Cowan affair. And he was somebody who everyone within politics kind of thought was overlooked for cabinet the first time around. He'd been made chief whip. And so everyone was kind of like, oh, you know, fair play, Dara's become a minister. And it was 17 days. And so that when he was gone that morning, then you're on to day two. And the day two was kind of mad.
Yeah. Mm. Dara didn't do Morning Ireland. He did do Midwest Radio that day. And so that was the first we heard from him.
So amongst all these radio shows that I was on, so I was on Midwest, and I just told the same story, that Dara had put his hands up immediately, he'd apologised immediately, he'd done the right thing. And then I had just said, you know, if anyone who knows Dara Kaleri in politics, they won't be surprised. He's a very honest and very genuine person. They said, thank you very much. But I didn't realise that Dara Kaleri was the next guest on after me, and he had heard everything that I had said.
Look, I made a big mistake. I shouldn't have gone to the function. I didn't want to let people down. And I'm taking responsibility for that mistake. I'm putting my hand up. I've let people down. I've angered a lot of people. I've stressed a lot of people that had to make very difficult calls in the last 6 months about family funerals, etc. I've got messages to say how annoyed and angry and distressed they are. With all of that in mind, I'm taking full responsibility for my actions. I was part of the cabinet meeting on Tuesday that decided new regulations. I should have been aware of them.
Once you realised that the media had gotten hold of this story, and we spoke earlier on to Aoife Moore, and you did speak candidly and openly to her and told her straight up that you had attended. The question really is, did Micheál Martin ask for your head on a plate?
No, he didn't. You know, I had a conversation with Aoife yesterday, and then, you know, the more I thought about it right through the night, I assure you. And yeah, I had a couple of conversations with the Taoiseach about it, but my own mind was coming around that I needed to put my hand up, that I needed to stand up And I needed to say, I've messed up here. I have damaged the national effort to try and take on COVID. I have damaged the government, and therefore I am going to resign.
And I don't think he would mind me saying this now because time has passed, but I've never said this publicly. But after he resigned from his job, Dara Cleary texted me and said, "No hard feelings, Aoife, you're a wonderful journalist." And that's just the sort of person that Dara Cleary is. We at this table, we all know that some politicians are incredibly thin-skinned, but the good politicians, great politicians, know that they have a job to do and we have a job to do, and they don't take it personally. And Dara Cleary is one of them people.
And he is back around the cabinet table now. And it was interesting to hear because, you know, the reaction bloomed from there. Coverage all over. I mean, I remember the callers into Lunchtime Live here, but Liveline as well kind of had one of their iconic episodes that day.
I am speechless that a man who came on the news the other day explaining how COVID loves to party. Well, obviously, the judge of the Supreme Court is one that loves to party. Dara Cleary loved to party. So did Mr. Buttermer and Mr. Phil Hogan. It's time that we woke up in this country and seeing what is going on around us. I am livid at this, and I cannot put it into words how angry I am. All being paid out of the public purse. All being paid out of my taxes and out of your taxes.
The one that always got me was the people who had missed funerals.
Yeah. Because funerals were down to 10 at one point. They were down to 6 at another.
Even.
And people were ringing Liveline, Lunchtime Live, and they were saying, "I went without. I missed my granny's funeral. I missed..." There was a woman who, on Liveline,
Mr. Fowler's funeral.
Mr. Fowler's funeral. Had to watch it on a webcam. And that was the tenor of what they were getting at. "We've put so much in over the last 5 months. Why couldn't they go without a dinner?"
Do you have to gather after a golf outing? You know, can you not just do your business on the golf course and then afterwards say goodbye? I had to bury my mother with no funeral. She was in a nursing home. I didn't see my mother for 6 to 7 weeks. The nursing home went on lockdown. We tried so many times to go and visit her. There was no facility to do that. She was literally died on her own in a nursing home with no one around her, no family. Look, it was literally taken from the nursing home, put into a box, exactly the way she was in the bed, in them zip-up bags, brought to a funeral home. We went in to view her. I have children living overseas. They weren't able to come home to visit them. They made a sacrifice. I couldn't even hug my sister, my brother. Nothing. I'm still suffering every day.
And I was actually off. I was supposed to be off that Friday for annual leave. And I did all the radio in the morning. I had booked to get my hair done because the hairdressers were finally open and I could finally get an appointment.
So I have the front page. My parents got it for me framed. So it's in my office. So I see it all the time. The front page that we did was kind of an editorial almost.
An editorial.
So there was the front page headline was like, "Anger at one rule for them, one rule for us." And then it was a kind of a joint byline from us. And then you had done a column.
I wrote that column from the hairdressers. I had my laptop sitting on my knee. They had Liveline on in the hairdressers. And I was sitting with my laptop and writing this column about how angry people were. I always remember there was a wee woman sitting next to me getting a blue rinse or getting a perm or whatever. This like wee old lady.
Not the stereotype.
Not the stereotype, but like a real wee Dublin granny. And she turned around to me and she pointed to the radio and she went, "Did you hear that?" And I said, "Yeah." And she was like, "Isn't that..." in very colourful language. She said, "Isn't that terrible?" And I was like, "Yeah." Little did she know. And I remember in the aftermath, people kept asking myself and Paul, "Oh, you must be so angry. You must be so angry." But I didn't even think about myself at all. All I could think about was people with children with disabilities, you know, adult children in homes, grandparents in homes, funerals. You weren't even thinking about yourself. Like, I was so, so angry for people who had lost.
Yeah, and then there's the flip side of that as well, that some people in the days after who took up the contrary position, assumed that we were coming from a place of like vendetta or vindictiveness. Yeah. And it was like, we got the tip, we followed the facts where they went, and we did the job. I mean,
do you remember the fella that didn't? There was this fella, he got really offended that it was called Gulfgate. He was a big golf fan, and he was like, "Golf actually isn't the problem. You should start calling it Hotelgate." I think about him all the time.
You're giving golf a bad name.
You've given golf a bad name. And then, because I made the point on, actually, I think it was News Talk, I made the point that the fact it was golf didn't help matters.
Which it didn't.
Golf is seen as a very middle class, upper class pastime that no one in my family has ever played. It's not an activity that is played a lot where I'm from. And I said that it perpetuated an image that these people are of a different set.
Yeah.
And then the golfers came for me. I'm like, actually, golf is open to all people.
Yeah, yeah. There was this almost Venn diagram of arrogance, right? And if you picked out four professions that people think are the most arrogant, politicians, judges, journalists, and I don't know,
professional golfers
would probably be in that top four. And it was like the culmination of everything that gets up people's noses, yeah. Paul, in one room.
That's it. It was a perfect storm of context about what was happening in terms of COVID. And then the fact that it was not just politicians, it was a politicians' golf society, which included ex-politicians, bankers.
So let's get on to the, because Dara Cleary's resigned at this stage, and that starts the domino of pressure on other people to resign. And I don't know where you want to start. Do you want to start with the judge? Do you want to start with the commissioner?
Don't forget Jerry Bottomer.
There was that. There was three Fine Gael senators who lost the whip. There was three Fianna Fáil senators who lost the whip. Mm-hmm. All were reinstated within a couple of months. It wasn't a hugely kind of detrimental thing. Pretty much all of them put their hands up and said, And to be fair, most of the people who were there just said, look, hands up, shouldn't have been there. So yeah, that was kind of came in the afternoon. But then the questions were about Phil Hogan and Seamus Wolfe. Phil Hogan, particularly, European Commissioner at the time for trade, wasn't based in Ireland. So what was he even doing there?
Yeah.
He's coming home from Brussels.
Phil Hogan became his own saga in that, tracking his movements from Brussels, getting pulled over by the Gardaí for using the phone,
yes,
then going to Gulfgate. We could do our own podcast on how Phil Hogan handled Gulfgate.
It was almost the opposite to Dara Cleary in that he dug the heels in. I think people remember in particular that interview with Tony Connolly that he did when he basically said, I did nothing wrong, going nowhere.
Yeah, he looked at Citizens Advice. That was the get out. He looked at citizensadvice.ie and they had told him he was in the clear, so he was in the clear.
I was no risk to anybody, so I was free to go, according to my medical people.
Not according to the and Department also, of Foreign Affairs?
Yes, but no, hold on. And I didn't accept their word fully for that. I observed a website, which is the Citizens Information website, which is clear for anybody to see, that I could go anywhere I wished without being isolated because of the fact that I had a negative test in relation to COVID-19. And that is, I think most reasonable people, when you consult a website which is funded by the HSE and the state agencies, that they will see deliberately that it's there in black and white. If you do not have COVID-19 and you're tested negatively, you are not obliged to self-isolate. It's there in black and white. So are the state agencies saying that they're giving wrong information to the citizens?
Well, no, the state agencies are making a distinction between self-isolating if you have symptoms and the requirements that you are obliged to follow if you're coming in from a high-risk country. They're two distinct obligations.
Well, I don't accept that.
I think at the time, people might remember, or they might not, that if you had come home from abroad, you had to do a two-week quarantine. I think you had to fill out a form, didn't you? I never travelled in that period, but I think you had to fill out a form and say, I will be at this address for 2 weeks. And the guards could...
The guards were empowered
to come and check if you were at the address. One of those things that at the time seemed, yeah, perfectly normal, yeah, but...
Seems totally bizarre now.
Absolutely insane when you actually view it with the fullness of time. So within that two-week period, he had been spotted. You know, trying to pin down his dates was very difficult. And he was kind of a bit woolly in the interview with Tony Connolly about when certain things happened. And we started getting contacts that were saying he was here.
I saw him there. And to be sure, just for people listening, Phil wasn't answering his phone during this time, so you couldn't get an answer out of him.
It got to the point where we'd so many sightings of him that you were convinced he was a myth.
Yeah.
Like he was...
like the abominable snowman, Phil Hogan.
Bigfoot was constantly seen in Kilkenny.
Constantly seen in and around Kildare.
And one person had come to me and said, look, I know he was in Adair. He was playing golf in Adair. He wasn't staying in the manor. He was staying in the hotel opposite. I can't remember the name of the hotel. I was relatively sure this person was telling the truth, but our rule, as anyone's is in this situation, was that you need two sources, that you need to confirm it. And a man sent me an email and he said, I've just been reading your piece on Phil Hogan about his dates. He was definitely in Adair on this date, and I rang the guy and he went over it and he showed me his receipts from the place. He was like, I wouldn't have missed Phil Hogan. He's 6'5". He walks into the breakfast at the hotel. You're gonna notice him. But I remember going back to Phil Hogan's spokesperson. I said, look, I have two people who put Phil Hogan in Adair here. It would have been day 13 of his 14-day quarantine. He would have broken the rules, whatever about the rules of whatever Citizens Advice says about Golfgate. The passage of linear time is fairly inarguable. And I remember the thing came back and said, I can confirm Phil Hogan was in Adair. And I went back and I said, yeah, but on what date? And he said, that's all I can confirm. He was in Adair. I was like, okay, grand, we have him.
Mm. Right.
And this was the same day that he'd given Ursula von der Leyen a dossier or like an account of his movements.
Because that became then the question point. And he, I think to this day, Phil Hogan feels aggrieved about what happened and about how, in particular, Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar at the time handled it.
What I always say to people now when I talk about Golfgate is there's a great lesson in life here is that in life you can be Dara Cleary or you can be Phil Hogan. Phil Hogan half-heartedly apologised. What politicians never seem to learn is that the drip, drip, drip of misinformation and then factual information is so much worse than just coming out and saying what you did in the first place. So Paul been able to place him in Adair. Then we heard the Gardaí stopped him on the road for using his phone while he was driving. It would have been so much easier to just come out and say, I didn't check the rules before I got here and this is what's happened and I'm sorry.
Did you expect better from the two leaders of government here?
Yes, well, I expected a process of where I could get a chance to explain myself. But they went on this populist, you know, wave of indignation, you know, about what was after happening on that occasion without actually analysing anything. And the conversations I had with the Taoiseach and the Tánaiste, you know, were leaked to the media. When I was speaking to them, they were talking about how we could actually explain what had happened. And at the same time, they were writing a letter that was going to appear in the front page of the Sunday Independent and calling for my resignation, effectively, or to consider my position, is the way they put it. And they were feeding the information through the government system to the President of the Commission as if what they were saying was actually fact. And we subsequently see from a recent court case that it turned out to be wrong.
Why do you think they did that?
Well, I think there was a domino effect created by the resignation of the Minister for Agriculture, Dara Cleary, at the time. And he was actually sitting beside me at the same event. So they felt that, I suppose, when he had to resign or was forced to resign, that was fair game to go after the Fine Gael man, the commissioner.
Yeah, and he remains the only one to pay a long-term political consequence for this out of it all, because the other big name that involved the judiciary in a scandal that is really unprecedented in the history of Ireland's courts is Seamus Wolfe.
Seamus Wolfe was the Attorney General, so he helped actually draft up the emergency COVID legislation at the time. He was then due to go on and sit on the Supreme Court, obviously a huge thing in any person in the legal profession's life. The head of the Supreme Court at the time, Frank Clark. Then this wasn't actually our work. This was Danny McConnell's stories then. Only Danny could start a constitutional crisis. But we found out then that Frank Clark had written to Seamus Wolfe and asked him not to take his seat on the Supreme Court, which was completely, I believe, unheard of in Irish history, because there was no way to reject him from the court. Then there was a number of meetings held between the Supreme Court and Seamus Wolfe and that he had to account for his actions within Golfgate. And eventually he spoke to all the Supreme Court judges. They were very torn on what they wanted, but there was no precedent for this. Seamus Wolfe decided to do his own thing anyway, and he still sits on the Supreme Court.
And remains the Supreme Court. And it's an interesting, Paul, legacy, I suppose, to round this chat out. Looking at it 5 years on, I think a lot of us look at the COVID restrictions, like we've said in the course of this, is God, wasn't that a bit mad at the time?
Yeah.
And there's less jeopardy to it. You had the court case. Obviously, no one was found guilty in that particular case.
Yeah, and people came at us over that.
Yeah.
People were like messaging or like tweeting at me like that we should apologise to Seamus Wolfe because there was no criminal case. We didn't bring a criminal case.
Like, we never said these people have broken the law.
But if I said Sean broke the law today, I'm not empowered to arrest him. Yeah. I'm not empowered to bring a criminal case against him. I'm not the TPP.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what power these people think I wield? I mean, if I was able to use that power, I would use it against all of my enemies and not just members of the judiciary. I'm just glad to know
you have a list of enemies that's ready to go.
Yeah, but I mean, it's localized and it mostly focuses on sports beef. But I don't know what people wanted from us a couple of years later. You know, the DPP took the case and the judge threw out the case. Grand.
He has found the last 2 years stressful with this hanging over him. He looks forward now to putting the matter behind him.
A lot of friends lost their positions in life. Serious positions that had taken 25 and 30 years to put there. And I hope that the people who made the decisions on those occasions will now, when they have been vindicated, put those good people back in the long term.
But do you think that that incident and the general passage of time has just changed how people perceive Golfgate, and that now they see, maybe it was overblown?
I do think when the court case happened, I was like, Jesus, people have a short memory. There was people then who were like, oh, it should have never went to court anyway. We never said this should happen. The DPP should take a case. They should go to court. That the pub should close. Nothing like that was ever said by us. We basically stated the facts of who was there, what the rules were, and that they had broken the rules. There was this notion that we had started a witch hunt. And I think with time that passed, a lot of people, now they're not the majority, but they're a very, very loud minority of people who then said, oh, it was all a witch hunt anyway, and we should never have went after these people. But there was also a lot of people saying, actually, I didn't get to go to my dad's funeral. I didn't get to go to my wedding. So I think it depends on how your COVID experience was, I think, as well. A lot of people lost their jobs and never recovered. One of my friends is a musician. He was due to go on tour in March, and his career never, ever took off again. You know, there's loads of things you wouldn't think about. Relationships, including my own, broke down in COVID, and a lot of people did really well out of COVID as well. And I would say, and me and Paul said this at the time, there was a feeling in Irish politics for a long time that no one ever had any accountability for their actions. We never saw actual consequences for anything. And I think Golfgate gave people this hope that maybe there might be some consequences sometime.
But to end on this point then, Paul, has that followed through? Because other than Phil Hogan, Dara Cleary's back as a minister, John Cummins is a minister, Jerry Buttimer is back as a TD, Seamus Wolfe is still a Supreme Court judge. Like, long term, really hasn't been any consequences.
No, but I do think that there is a point to be made there, that if you apologise and if you take your medicine in the short term, that we can overcome these things. And I think it's healthier to have a society that says accountability does not mean that you're hung, drawn and quartered, or you're taken out the back and shot. You apologise, you take your punishment, and that there is a route back. Because I think we would actually have better long-term accountability if people were able to say, hands up, got it wrong, and that it wasn't terminal, and that not every mistake had to be, and that if they approached it correctly, if they were genuinely sorry, if they atoned, that we have that route back. I actually think that Dara Cleary's case speaks more to the society I would like to see than anything else. Hands up, immediately, apologised, resigned without dragging the government into a crisis, worked hard as a TD, got the chance to come back as a junior minister, worked hard there, and became a senior minister. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I wouldn't like to think that the biggest mistake I ever made would damn me for life or ruin my career. That you could say, look, I'm very sorry about that, that you would take some measure of punishment and that you would be able to move on.
Maybe the message of Golfgate is everybody makes mistakes, but you should always try and tell the truth.
Aoife Moore and Paul Hosford, who joined me on News Talk Daily back in August to mark 5 years since Golfgate. Thank you so much for your company today. Ciara Doherty will be here tomorrow with another highlight from the podcast archives. For now, from me, Sean Defoe, goodbye.